On this episode of AV Week, we look back at 2016, what were the most downloaded and listened to shows, some of the highlights and lowlights of 2016. Everything from AMX's security issues to a ton of mergers and acquisitions. All that and more, next on AV Week.
The network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
AV Week is brought to you by our fine group of underwriters, companies like Atlas IED. This is AV Week, episode 278, recorded Friday, December 23rd, 2016. The best of 2016.
Ready.
AV Week.
Performing scan.
AV Week.
Online.
This is AV Week. This is AV Week, your weekly wrap-up of audiovisual news and information. My name is Tim Albright. I am the host and producer, also founder of AV Nation. Thank you so much for listening. This episode, we typically do around Christmas time simply because all of you and all of us are getting ready for the holidays. Whichever holiday you celebrate, we want to wish you a very happy holidays. What we do is we take a look at our most downloaded shows. So whichever ones you, our wonderful audience, who continues to come back week after week, whichever ones you guys download the most, we look back and say, okay, which part of those episodes made those so popular? So some of them range everywhere from some security issues earlier in the year to tons of mergers and acquisitions. First episode we're going to look at was the week we found out about some of the security issues that Ars Technica had with AMX.
It's not very often that we get this holy crap ginormous story in AV, and we have one this week. AMX. All right. So this story first appeared on Ars Technica, so that's the one I'm going to use. AMX, according to them and according to the security consulting firm SEC Consult, said they discovered a backdoor after analyzing the AMX NX1200, the AMX NX1200. It's a Netlinks product. Okay, and short version of this story, basically, SEC Consult found a couple of different backdoors that, first of all, the backdoor login and was not made available if you tried to search for all of the available logins. It would not show up on that list, so it was a hidden backdoor, it was a hidden username. And they're making, Ars Technica is making hay, CNN Money is making hay, because AMX has a large presence in government, Department of Justice, Department of Defense, the White House. Actually, the war room down in the White House has an AMX processor and AMX touch panel in it. The story on CNN Money says the title is "Hackers Could Secretly Tap Into Corporate Meetings," and the picture, I'll bring it up here for those of you watching on video. The picture is actually a picture of the president, President Obama, sitting along with Joe Biden and a bunch of others, and it's grayed out except for the nice red circle over the AMX touch panel. So let's just say this wasn't a great PR week for AMX. We've got friends at AMX. We've known them for a long time. Great folks, great group of folks down in Texas. Last year, they were purchased by Harman. For those of you who keep track of this sort of things, Harman is only down $2 on trading. So it's not exactly like it's, oh my gosh, it's the end of the world and everybody's selling off Harman stock. So doing what we do and trying to be as responsible as, you know, as we can, we reached out to AMX, reached out to Harman. And this is what we got from Sean Robinson, who's taken over for Joanne Drulis there at AMX. Sean is now the director and CEG of Solutions and Marketing. This is their official media statement, I guess, is what they've given us here. In addition to that, they also provided us with the letter that they sent out to integrators, which we'll make available as well. But this is their statement, quote unquote. Let me make sure I get this right. First, we want to clarify the risks and terms being discussed. Black Widow was an internal name for a legacy diagnostic and maintenance login for customer support of technical issues, commonly used in legacy systems. It was not a quote-unquote hidden as suggested, nor did it provide access to customer information. While such a login is useful for diagnostics and maintenance, during our routine security review in the summer of 2015, we determined that it would be prudent to eliminate this feature as part of a comprehensive software update. We informed our customers, and the update was deployed in December 2015. The one that looks like Batman login was an entirely different internal feature that allowed internal system devices to communicate. It was not an external login, nor was it accessible from outside of the product. The Batman internal system device capability was not related to, nor was it a replacement for Black Widow, which was the name of the other login. The only connection was the fact that our software update in December eliminated Black Widow and updated it to Batman. In terms of the names, those were lighthearted internal project names that our programmers used with no intent or meaning. We take security very seriously and are continuously testing our own systems and capabilities and developing more sophisticated updates. End quote. All right. So there's Harmon's position. There's our testing and the security. That's where we sit right here, right now, from all that we know. A couple of issues that I've gotten, and then we'll get you guys' things. If this is true, the whole backdoor thing and the login and the password, I get it. Programmers are geeks, right? They're going to name them silly things. I don't have an issue with that. Ars Technica probably does, but you know, whatever. They need to get a sense of humor. It's a firmware update, okay? And God love them, not just AMX, but every other manufacturer on the planet. You give me a firmware update for no particular reason, I'm probably not going to update it, right? What's the old thing? You don't update firmware on Friday because, God help you, you're probably going to break something, right? The other thing is you're going to have a number of people who can't get back into their clients to update this software. We're talking about the freaking White House. It's not like I can call up Michelle Obama and say, hey, can I swing by for a second? I've got to update your... You can't do that, right? So those are my only two biggest concerns with Harmon's statement. My concerns with Ars Technica and the security company is, I think personally they're making a lot out of nothing, especially according to Harmon. The Batman one was not external. You could not get in from the outside. I don't know whether or not you could. I don't have that product and can't verify one way or the other. All right. So there's where we are. Those are my statements. Mr. Tucker, we'll start with you. How big of a deal is this?
Well, I guess it's all perception, isn't it? If you're really scared about any kind of backdoor entry into a system that's supposed to be secure, this is troublesome, especially when you don't know about it. The worst thing to fear is the thing that you do not know. And I think that's a lot of what's happening here. I mean, having worked for a manufacturer, there are lots of parts of those boards that probably have access for the engineers. So when they get them, they can diagnose them quickly and get internal information. Are most of those accessible to the common person? No. And would you have to tap in directly? Yes. But we're talking about government agencies. We're talking about military knock centers for, you know, emergency services or in the light of some national emergency, right? So I think that's where the paranoia is coming from, fueled further by that there seemed to have been no real public response for people. When Ars Technica picked it up, you figure, okay, niche market. When I think Gizmodo mentioned it, it was on Reddit very quickly. Some friends sent it to me. But when CNN Money picks it up, it's because there's a natural fear with everything we know about the modern world and its dangers, right? So I think that's really where it's from. And it was just the not knowing. But as we'll probably cover, and I spoke with Dave Danto today, who couldn't actually make it to be with us to talk a little bit about this, but this is the common problem, the IoT stuff that I think even Melissa can talk about, where what are the backdoors and what do we need to fear and how far do they go? If we don't know, we fear them.
All right. So good segue there, Melissa, from your standpoint. As someone who works for a manufacturer, how big of a deal would this be?
Well, I think, obviously I work in the technology side. So I have nothing to do with our products or how they're manufactured. I'm clearly just education. But for me, I think that this is very concerning. I think Harman's probably, or AMX probably, they got picked on. They got caught. I imagine that we'll find there are lots of backdoors and a lot of products out there, and that's the part that's the most alarming. I think the other thing that's alarming is notice how quickly we've jumped on the manufacturer and not the IT division. Nobody's talking about the lack of security within the IT network. It's look at the weakest point, which right now they're showing to be this product. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that with the introduction of IoT or IoE. We are a pretty weak link overall because we're not talking about it. We're not educating people about it yet. We need to get on the bandwagon. We need to be aware of, can our products be secure? And how do we make them secure? This is a great opportunity for our integrators, for the teams out there, to offer another value-added service to their menu of offerings. But we've got to be educated. We've got to get better aware of how these devices are working on these networks.
2016 was a pretty good year if you were Control 4. Not only did they have the announcement at Cydia that they were able to connect with Alexa, but also had a significant acquisition earlier on in the year where they picked up PackEdge. This is a rumor that was starting probably about a month or so ago. And if you're watching the screen, I'll throw this story up here. So about a month or so ago, I got two different phone calls from folks, and neither one like would confirm or be on the record, so there was no point in writing a story about it. Control 4 might be buying somebody, right? And then it was somebody, part of that was also that somebody might be buying Control 4, but that obviously was not the case. And suddenly, out of nowhere, I guess is the best way to put this, yesterday, a bunch of folks in the media and on the Twitterverse and on the Facebooks got this announcement: Control 4 acquiring PackEdge device and software, a leader in advanced home networking. This is obviously a press release. But here's the thing, guys. I'm not going to say it was shocking, right? First of all, Control 4 is a publicly traded company, right? So there's a couple of ways that you can keep investors happy and people who own your stock happy. One is to grow through market share and this. Another way to grow is through acquisition, right? Mark, we're going to kick it off with you here. What does this say about Control 4, and is this a good move on their part?
I think it's a good move. I mean, Control 4 uses a variety of different technologies, obviously, to control things within the house. You know, they use some Zigbee protocol or Z-Wave. They're compatible, obviously, with Wi-Fi. Their devices on the network. You know, they just came out with two new controllers for the home, got rid of their old stuff. I think it's a good thing. I think it helps them manage devices remotely better if they have a window into the network and they can control that network a little better. It gives them, I guess, an advantage over somebody like Savant that's maybe not selling that switch and those Wi-Fi routers and has a chance to manage that through the home control system, right? So I was a Control 4 dealer in Arizona for quite a few years, so I might be a little partial to that. For me, this was a little surprising only because, you know, kind of the rumor in the space for a long time was Control 4 wasn't in this business for the long haul, that they really just wanted to build a business to sell. And to see them putting money into another business and making their business bigger, I think may go a little ways to kind of dispel that rumor that they're not here to build a new control company, but just to be acquired by someone else.
That's a really good point, dude, is the fact that you're right. That was one of the rumors, especially when they went public, right? Mm-hmm. That was one of the people who were against them going public were like, well, you know, they're just trying to, you know, make a quick buck, because nobody in this business makes a quick buck. So,
sure.
Mr. Cordell, from your standpoint, what does this mean from a control standpoint, also is from a business standpoint?
Yeah, you know, I think Mark hit on it in terms of being able to remote in. I mean, that's, you know, having that window into the network is a huge plus that PackEdge really did beautifully and elegantly. So I think it's a huge win for Control 4. And, you know, if they're looking to get bought by somebody, maybe maybe Crestron would buy them so they could come out to Cedia. Who knows?
Wow.
Just saying. Too easy. Too easy.
All right.
From a business standpoint, you're absolutely right, though. Acquisitions and mergers, man, is you know, that's something that you got to keep an eye out for. And it's an excellent way to diversify your product offerings. And so I think this is like a match made in heaven that puts them ahead of, you know, all the other control manufacturers that don't have that leg up from the networking standpoint, because as we all know, you know, everything's on the network now and more devices are, you know, piling on by the day. So,
well, yeah. let's get a network expert on. Mr. Zeely, both of these guys have made really good points about this giving Control 4 a leg up when it comes to networking stuff. Was this a good move on their part?
I think in the market that Control 4 lives in, which is the home market, it's absolutely a good move, because for their stuff to work, it has to work well on the network, and to be able to limit it out and provide that network environment for the home that's being built. It makes a lot of sense. It also gives them a really good base to get into what's going to be the really hot part of the whole home automation IoT, which is going to be controlling the gateway. So PackEdge has a number of network control products and things that will allow them to start to unify how various devices are managed on multiple networks. So with what PackEdge already has, they have a way to start building IP to Zigbee gateways that can securely allow you to get into the home and not force you to be reliant on external services. And that's going to be the big key in that market, because as well as what Control 4 has already done within apps, they'll be able to unify, because I have a lot of home automation stuff, and it drives me crazy to have to switch app to app to app. And so this will give them a chance to become that unifying presence glue to bring things together, and we'll really jump them up in that space if they play it right. Hmm. That being said, even combined, they're tiny against some of the forces that are getting into that space. So even to be acquired, they're going to have to bulk up. A $30 million company is not a attractive acquisition to a Google or an Apple or some of these companies that are getting in. They want to buy a $300 or $400 million company. So even if they're trying to get acquired, they're going to have to bulk up to really get, you know, that top dollar company that wants to acquire them.
Okay, so hang on for a second, because you're right. Apple and Google both are trying to make inroads into the home space. Not that either of them are hurting for money.
Right.
So they have a chance, and you're right. They're typical, you know, more successful, not more successful company, but more market cap companies. But could possibly another company then, if you know, I don't know, I'm going to say Crestron, but you know, Cisco or another networking company capture them, or does that not make any sense?
No, they absolutely could. The big issue, and it was strange because I never really thought about it, but I've looked at companies and said, gee, that would be a great thing just to acquire into Harman. And Harman doesn't want to buy companies that have a $20 million. It's a lot of work for a large company to buy a company. So they want to bring in maximum, and there are thresholds that, and I don't know where they exist within various things, but they don't necessarily suck up smaller companies. And if you're looking at the mass consumer market, I mean, Control 4, as large as it is within the AV thought of the home automation market, in the mass consumer market, it's still tiny. And so I think bulking up and becoming a company with a $100 million valuation actually will make them more attractive to be bought, as well as they've picked up a significant intellectual property portfolio here, which is going to make them more attractive for acquisition, if that is what they want to do.
Yeah, if that's what they want. But, you know, Phil and Mark both made really good points about the fact that it kind of solidifies their network acumen, I think.
Well, and it has to be. They have to do that because it's bad enough going into a corporate space that has professional discipline. You don't necessarily want to support every home router and switch set and goes, because all the customer ever says is that control system doesn't work.
Yeah.
And, you know, what are you using? Oh, I'm using this D-Link hub that's been, you know, working flawlessly for the last 18 years.
Yeah. And I think that's a good point. And with their new, you know, with their new line of controllers and things, you know, they're really focusing on streaming, not only streaming music services, but also streaming local collections and things like that. And when you're starting to tout that you stream media through the house, you want to be able to make sure that the media is streaming properly. And the only way to do that is to have a good network in place. So,
right.
Absolutely.
And they can just say, you know, if you put in our network,
yeah,
it's going to work. And,
yeah,
and it becomes very easy on tech support to say, you know, we'll give you better support if you put in our network switch, because we'll understand the end-to-end environment.
Yeah, and you could even have drop-down QoS settings per port based on what's at the other end,
yeah,
on that node.
Yeah, and you have templates, you have standard ways of doing it. And in the scheme of things, it's not, chances are a home automation system is going to buy some level of network anyway, and it becomes a single point of purchase for the customer, which is, you know, always attractive.
Integrated Systems Europe is actually just around the corner, about 6-8 weeks away. But one of our most downloaded shows was one that we did live from the show floor at ISE 2016.
Adrian, you interviewed a lot of folks this week, and me, so thank you very much for that.
No problem.
Right before I got on was Mike Blackman, the
yes,
gentleman that runs ISE. And I've heard different numbers over the last 28 hours of the attendance of this year,
mm-hmm,
right? So to put this into context, ISE has traditionally, last year was about 59,000-60,000, right? I have heard numbers between 65,000 and 66,000,
mm-hmm,
for this year. If that's true, how remarkable and how much has that paid off that fourth day?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I wonder if the fourth day has been a tremendous success. That's the first thing to say. There was a lot of cynicism, I think, about the fourth day, including for myself. I probably didn't go that public about the fourth day as much as I would Chinese LED, for example. But there was certainly a lot of cynicism about the fourth day, whether it was worthwhile doing, whether it would just delay the traditional last day, making the last day quiet, the next day the last day quiet. But that's not really worked out that way. I wonder if the numbers would have gone up even if you didn't have the fourth day. The fourth day is more about keeping continuity of numbers on each day. So every stand that we've spoken to of size has said that their Wednesday number is the same as their Tuesday number, or pretty much the same. Sorry, the Wednesday number and the Thursday number, sorry, I'm a mistake. So you effectively have two middle days.
Right.
So if you have two middle days, your numbers are going to be good, but it's spacing people out. I think ISE was always on an upward curve. I'm not sure you could say that we got an extra 5,000 or 6,000 people because of the fourth day. I think you would have got an extra 4,000 or 5,000 people anyway, personally. I think the fourth day is a brilliant thing. I think it's very clever. I wasn't a fan of it to start with. It's absolutely brilliant because what the stands have done is they've made their numbers on day three. So the Thursday close was when they made the numbers. Everything else is additional. And you can see from here with the noise, it's actually not quiet. You know, we've been on the NEC stand all day and it's been busy. And we've had a lot more senior executives who've had more time. They're busy on the Tuesday, they're busy on the Wednesday. Journalists like Clive and I, we can't get hold of the CEOs of some of these big companies. You know, they're out meeting partners and clients, not press.
Yeah.
So we've had a lot of opportunities Thursday afternoon and Friday to do that. So
I have two minds about the numbers game. You know, you've only got to go through to CES and you'd find a fantastic number of people about 10 o'clock, it's like walking through a tree pool. So you don't want huge hordes numbers of people just going in there. And it's obviously directly to do with how much people are paying to be here of the week, so that's where the numbers come in valuably. In practical terms, we always thought that the option was to split the week, so you got the last 2 days where you switch your staff over and start to treat the show quite differently. So you've got your core show doing one
thing. Very good idea.
Get the fresh stuff in Thursday, Friday, create an event. Well, Mike was quite right doing that. So he's trying to make Friday an interesting day. And as you say, there are a lot of people here. You know, it's not exactly empty.
Yeah.
But you do sort of sniff a bit of a different atmosphere going on. So instead of being afraid that no one's going to come, you be positive and start to plan people will be coming, but you need to create a different sort of atmosphere towards the end of the week, so you almost split into two sorts of events. But it's a business show. You want to see people who are going to be potentially business prospects and have the space to be able to give them justice. So you don't want the whole place crawling with people. You know, numbers are always relative to me. I don't know. It's always been a journalist's game, crawling numbers, you know. But there are a lot of people here, because even the state of Europe, it's nice to see a potentially busy, active, and, you know, pretty positive atmosphere.
I think Price makes a good point. I think moving forward, the exhibitors have to look at it differently. I think, because, you know, I sit down because I'm doing what you're doing every day of the week.
Yeah.
What you're doing, we're sitting down, not working. I mean, you guys have walked around, and I know George has been walking around because I've been following on his Twitter.
Yeah.
And he's been to the far ends of the earth, I think, and he's probably covered 10 miles a day or something. People who are standing on their feet all day, the exhibitors, have to change the way they're doing the thing. And I think what Clive suggests, you turn your staff around maybe. You know, it's a long day for the poor staff members who stand there on their feet all day. So that's the difference. We don't have very many four-day shows. You know, CES is a big long show, and you're right, the numbers are bonkers, and they just let students treacle in and whatever. So
what we should do is have fewer people, because we all go up and down the aisles in Segways. It's this guy in Mayor's stand. I've been so close to nicking his Segway halfway through. I thought, you do not deserve it. I need that Segway.
What did you knock them
off? I want to put a video guy in the Segway, popping up and down. We did near the infocom, but I came so dangerously close to this poor man not coming out to the toilet and having his Segway nicked. I could just see myself coming out with some mad cartoonist on this Segway up and down the aisles. I've just been loving it.
But the number will be 65,000, 66,000.
Yeah.
There were 65. We interviewed the CEO of Infocom, you know him better, David Labuskas, yesterday. Yeah. And he said there were 65,000 pre-registered. Mike hinted in the keynote this morning, Dr. Kaka's keynote, that there was 65,000 to 66,000. So the number will be just a little bit north of that. If they get any more than 66,500, I would be surprised. But it's a great European success story.
It is.
You know, but it's an international event, and Infocom International should be pleased with themselves and the way they put it on. Very pleased with Mike Blackman. I mean, he's done a tremendous job of turning a show that was 2,800 people in year one, back in 2004, 2005. You know, up to what it is now. It's a tremendous success story. Really, really, really good.
You know, I have to say, though, in all of that conversation, it is an interesting mix of the residential and the commercial. And my suspicions last year were that it wasn't going to work, but it does really work well. I found myself knowing where I needed to go and knowing how I found the information. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a surprise to see a commercial in the space that I saw residential where it was. It really did work out well.
The scary thing is, when I interviewed Tim earlier this afternoon, or lunchtime today, and it's surprising to think that it's the first time that you guys, the AV Nation crew, came from last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've actually opened up this show to a whole new American audience. You know, however much I write about it, however much Clive writes about it, however much Gary Kay writes about it, you guys are probably the most influential people in North America, in both residential and professional. So you have opened it up to a new audience. You know, and I said to Mike Blackman off air, unfortunately, you probably can't use this in any correct, that, you know, it's great to have you here because more Americans will come. And I keep asking people, if you're an exhibitor, if you're a global supplier, you've got to come here. And who was it who said there was, I can't think who it was, somebody once today said that what they're now seeing, I think it might have been you, said that it was you, that you're going to see the Whisper Suites in Orlando or Las Vegas at Infocom in June. You get the things behind the closed doors, they play around with them, they show them in secret, and then they get launched during the beginning of a year. You said that. I know you definitely said that.
I think that's
really going to happen.
We had one specific product that we know for a fact that's what happened, right? A couple of our guys, Matt Scott and Harry Mead, ran across a microphone that they were like, oh my gosh, this is the greatest thing, and they started tweeting about it, and we got responses from some of our listeners that had seen that exact thing, again, behind NDA, behind the Whisper Suite back in Orlando last year at Infocom. So you're right, that is what's exactly going on. So, and you're very kind, we are not the most influential people in North America. Maybe the second.
I think you are, because you're the doers. Because
well,
you'd actually do it rather than just talk about it. So one of the interesting problems, and it'll be interesting from here Clive's perspective on it, is if I was in a startup and I was launching a product in this space, would I choose a show such as this to launch it? You sort of think yes, because that's the audience, but how do you get mind share? You know, you've got 65,000 people. Clive said that maybe they're not all business prospects. Mm. You know, you've got all this stuff. How do you actually make something special when you launch? You know, we've been doing some work for a couple of startups in the projector space, and they've been looking at things like Comic-Con, which actually, I know that Chris Netto's watching this now. It was Chris Netto's idea. You know, if I was launching a new product into this sort of space, I would do something completely bonkers. Mm. You know, Comic-Con is the bonkers thing. And I know he's done various things there with your thing. How would you get mindshare with that if you launched it? It's very, very difficult to do because you're competing against the Samsungs, the LGs, the Panasonic, and all the people from your world. So
it's difficult to stand out in a big show like this. So if you're going to go on someone's show, I mean, I've seen a sort of fantastic product from Stream TV Networks, which is
stereoscopic.
Thank you so much.
It's all right.
It's a Friday.
It is. And you've been here for 4 days.
Thank you. And the older Philips Eindhoven unit, which is a fantastic bunch of technicians who were bought by. Anyway, they come out with this fantastic rendering engine and algorithm that really sort of transforms instead of digital signage, it turns into 3D. It's the best example of that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And will make 4K screens zoom out of shots probably. It's OEM level, but you know, looking at retail and gaming and digital signage. That sort of thing stuck out, but as a new product, it will fly, but who noticed it? I came across it, went in there, and had a look at them. But you know, you are a bit of buried, unless you're on someone's back of the stand, or it's an expensive show to be at.
It is.
Because you know, for a small startup, you have to be carried by someone else, and that by that definition, you will already have been spotted to do that.
Well, and
so
the fourth day's already made it more expensive.
Well,
so.
And here's the thing though, we have a young man who, he is a startup, right? He's a programmer out of Germany. Has a neat little product. I'm a big believer in it. It's programming, you know, it's programming made simple. And I called him a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, and said, are you coming? You know, just out of curiosity, because he had exhibited at Infocom's Innovation Showcase, he had done it at Cedia. And he said they have, in ISC, had a number of smaller booths that were priced for the startups,
right?
Now, they don't have a rookie row. Like Cedia does. They don't have an innovation showcase yet, like Infocom does. But according to him, the price was right enough for a small startup, it's just he and his wife, to come show their wares, interface with people, network with other people, and show exactly what's possible out there, right? Because these are the folks who are innovating. Yes, the big players are absolutely innovating because they've got the engineering power behind them. But it's the guys and gals who are in their garages, coming up with the next thing that's actually really kind of exciting.
See, in the old days, when I was editing Which Computer in the 80s, we had all kinds of innovation that they came to us with, and we were able to follow a product from conception, almost design, before it became launched, and we positively encouraged interaction. Now we don't have any time to do that, or resources. You do wonder where the outlets are, but there are very few and far between. You know, how they get through, I don't know, so I watch university labs and so on. There is a shortage of institutions and organizations that create interest in developing projects. And it's difficult, it's very frustrating for me to try and look where the next innovation is coming. I'm always looking, and it's difficult to see where they're coming from. So it's a dialogue. I don't think a particular solution is going to come from any one show, but I think it's a whole system of how you develop and exhibit and get investors is perhaps something we ought to look at, isn't it?
Well, isn't that not part what Day 4 is for? I know I found a bunch of other people from some other trade organizations or other periodicals on today were doing the search. They did the required, they did the stuff they needed to do, and now they're going, what can I find? So Day 4 really has become the research, you know, search and destroy mission of what can I find that's interesting? You know, you said about the small startup. Part of that's here. This is technically called the Discover Center. So it's sort of like the innovation. I mean, and some of these are stands that we have seen at Infocom. Mm-hmm. Some of these guys we saw at the Innovation Showcase. Yeah. And AdGen and all those kind of guys. Far from there. So it's sort of there. But yes, you're right. That splash is very hard to make when you've got.
You need a Day 4 treasure hunt or something.
Yeah, and Day 4 is sort of treasure hunt.
Oh, well, that's good.
I mean, maybe they could
make
that's
an idea. So, you know, Mike Blackman has worked really hard at figuring out what we can do on Fridays with the CEO stuff, the exclusive stuff, Dr. Kakko's keynote today, free parking, woohoo for me, €17.50 saved. So he's looking for things like that. That's actually not a bad idea to do something like that, to make that Friday a bit special. He hinted today that, you know, his trouble, when I interviewed him today, his problem is he's raised the bar so high. How do you top that? You know, do you go more visitors? You know, does that help, as Clive says? You know, you can't have any more days at the moment. You know, he puts more events on. He wants to do a good keynote next year, but I mean, Dr. Kakko was brilliant. I mean, it's like, the bar is very high. So I think you need some innovation. And I said to a couple of my journalists I interviewed, I think they're the people that my Blackman should listen to. You know, i.e. us. Not just us, but you know what I mean. Because we see it from the outside, from a completely different perspective. Your job really is to find the next big thing. That's what you love. You're passionate about that whole thing. You love doing that. So those ideas would be great for a Friday to do. I mean, seriously, a treasure hunt, or you know, the Discover Day, or an incubation startup day, or showcase day.
A mini keynote speaker who comes to the innovation and talks about the new innovations, and then they'll draw to these people.
I'd like to have them all come to one place. I mean, some of the best press release stuff is when you know you get a bunch of journalists and people come in and have 10 minutes to present to you.
Yeah.
How much easier would that help Clive? You wouldn't need a segue, would he?
He wouldn't.
You know? But I mean, bring 50 people to Clive. The mountain's
a significant business deal, creating one of the biggest integration firms in the U.S. Diversified is acquiring, or has acquired, Technical Innovation. And this is from TVtechnology.com. Another one of the stories is from our buddies over at Commercial Integrator. Inside a mega merger, how and why $215 million Diversified acquired $180 million Technical Innovation. One of the emails I got from an integrator friend of mine said that this merger could very well be the biggest, quote unquote, the biggest integrator from a sales perspective. In other words, the most sales in the U.S. Now, yes, AVISPL is the big kahuna, but AVISPL has they have other offices outside the U.S. Actually, Matt talked with their U.K. office over at ISE and did an interview there. So, George, we'll start with you on this one. What does this mean for integrators, kind of the small folks and the medium-sized folks, when you have a deal like this going through?
Well, I think we're still in a stage where a lot of those medium-sized companies are starting to merge, where you can, you will. I think you get market share, you get pricing opportunities, and you get to be the guy on the block that everybody knows, and you do the work. It's going to be harder to be a mom and pop, just like when the Walmarts and the chain stores come into town. You're going to have to find a way to be very niche-y and perhaps diversify just a bit more. That's the way I see it, really.
Matt, you guys don't have huge acquisitions like this in general in Canada. But from a standpoint of watching this from kind of the outside just north, what does this do anything for you guys in your business?
Not directly in our business. The, you know, being a smaller integrator, we always would approach this type of conversation, especially with a client of, you know, they're a big firm. Yeah, they've got a bunch of offices. Yeah, but we're your local guys on the ground. We're the guys that are going to help you anytime. You're not going to call a 1-800 number. That would be kind of our approach in dealing with it. And then as far as just seeing this happen in the industry, I don't think it's bad. I think it's good. You know,
good for who though?
Good for them.
Okay. It's an honest question.
Yeah. It's not necessarily bad for the industry in general, other than the fact that, you know, as soon as you get the conglomerates, it just makes it harder for everybody else, to combat and go toe to toe with these guys. But to be honest, at the end of the day, I don't know if it really matters.
It's just another integrator.
You just have another big, massive integrator that is going to sell things based on their size and their scope and the fact that they have 47 offices in 47 states. No one, like, that doesn't care, or that doesn't carry any weight unless you need an integrator in those 47 states and you want it to be the same across the board. And that's where I see these big firms being effective. But what, now we're going to see AVISPL go up against, I'm sure I read it, but
let's,
I don't
call them Diversified.
Are they sticking with just Diversified? Okay, so they're going to go up. Like, does that really affect most of us unless we're in one of those 2/3 companies?
Yeah, probably not. You're right. Gina, from a manufacturer standpoint, I've always been curious about this when big mergers like this happen. Kind of like the opposite side of when Control 4 bought PackEdge a few weeks ago, right? You're going to have PackEdge dealers, you're going to have Control 4 dealers, and it'd be interesting to see how the two kind of meet. When you have big integrators like this, my expectation is that on some level they're at least interfacing with FSR, and they're some one of the two of them, I'm almost certain, is purchasing from FSR, right? So when you do that, how do you guys approach big companies like that, right? I'm not asking you out specifically, you know, diversified, but maybe, you know, AVISPL or some of the medium to large companies. How do you guys approach them when it comes to servicing them and making sure that they're taken care of?
So I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer to that. What we see is that we're going to have to learn what the new culture of that company is going to be. Do they allow the individual offices to make decisions, or is everything run through a headquarters? Who was a loyal FSR dealer before this, and you know, can we continue to keep up those relationships? You know, with AVISPL, there's a lot of autonomy in the regional offices, and we can go and we can see from a manufacturer standpoint a number of different people throughout the country, and some of them will say, you know, yeah, absolutely, we have some projects that are going on, and we have FSR specified. And there are others that say, you know, we don't have as much autonomy as somebody else, so we have to go through HQ for that, and then we'll talk to people in HQ. But I think what's going to happen, and especially since Diversified is right in our backyard in Kenilworth, New Jersey, it's really only, I don't know, 25 minutes from the office. So they were, and still are, very, very friendly FSR dealers. And it'll be interesting to see if the culture within the company actually changes based on these acquisitions. I know that the Technical Innovations is going to be kind of morphed into Diversified. And if that's the case, are there going to be hiccups along the way? For sure, I think the answer is. But does that change the way the employees, the employee power, the way they purchase, the way they work on projects, and you know, it'd be interesting to see.
No, it definitely will be. Mr. Mead, there, you work in and around DC with a lot of different companies, both big and small. Same kind of question to you as to Matt. What does this do to the medium and the not the obviously ginormous companies, but the medium to big companies that are used to going up against, you know, the big boys and girls in the block?
Pretty much. For me, it means that there's going to be less of the big bid work. Mm. That's going to get eaten up by them because they have the resources that can sit there and bid it and go through and do all the specs and everything else. So it means that for us, I think it means that we get much more boutique and much more service oriented and setting ourselves apart that way, as opposed to you're dealing with megalith XYZ, you're dealing with little guys who are actually able to give you the response time that you're looking for and the more personal touch that you're looking for.
Yeah, it's a really good
Tim, point. Can I ask a question really quick?
Sure.
Because I'm curious about that. I was kind of thinking about that myself, and my question is, you know, obviously small companies have a reputation to be able to move quicker, right? They're able to move quicker for their clients. Is this going to affect the way that clients or end users see the AV industry? If a big company like an AVISPL or Diversified Technical Innovations will end up coming in and doing a job for you, and they're not necessarily able to be as spry or limber as a smaller company, is that going to affect the way the AV industry is portrayed to others in the future? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. I don't know if it... Sorry, go ahead, Harry.
I was going to say a couple of things on that. We actually have gotten subcontracted before to run service for some of these bigger guys. So we end up being the local service contact for their customers. And but two, yeah... I've made a career of picking up after the big guys.
And that's actually not a bad career advice either.
No. There's something to be said for, you know, when you look at this application from the end user standpoint, there's something to be said for the client or the end user being happy with, you know, either buying local and supporting that local non-massive monopoly company. That's why, you know, Ace Hardware and Home Hardware and all those little companies still exist, even though Home Depot is on, you know, in every major town. But just as Harry said, you know, we get contracted as well for a fairly large integrator out of Dallas, and we do a ton of IT work both locally and in Toronto for this huge integrator out of Dallas that they don't have anyone on the ground up in Canada. So they contract companies like myself and others to do that kind of work. I think the long and short view for the end user will come down to the fact of, as long as they're maintaining what they determine to be an acceptable level of service and support, they probably won't really care whether, you know, whether AVI and Diversified merge again and become an even bigger company. It won't matter to them in the long run, because as much as, you know, we love our industry and we like to think our industry is huge in the grand scheme of things and for the general consumer, they don't really care. They just want their boardroom to work.
Yeah. That's all for us here. You know what? Thank you so much. Thank you so much for making us who we are. AV Nation is nothing without our audience and without the people that make it happen. Everybody from our producers, our hosts, the people that help us make AV Nation what it is. So thank you so much. We've got some more changes coming on, some things that we hope will serve you better. So check us out. A new website is coming along and should be posting sometime in January. We'll keep you up to date on that. So, from everybody here at AV Nation, happy holidays, happy new year. For more information about us, you can check us out at avnation.tv, avnation.tv. Thank you so much for listening. It's all the time we have for AV Week.